Saginaw.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What type of power play did you have over there? What actual place did he take?
Well, he was Arnold was a worker there. He worked at the foundry there for a while. Then in 1937, right after the sit down strikes, Arnold went on a $50 a week job, you know, to see what he could do for a while. And he didn't do too good. And then they brought up that Jimmy Suchok, that Jimmy that's down here.
As an organizer.
Yeah, he's an organizer. As an organizer then, but now he negotiates for the.
He's the business manager for the Jobbers Association in Detroit.
That he is now. Well, he was there, but they didn't seem to make too much progress at all. It hadn't seeped in yet. That is the spirit of it. The jobbing shops were strong, but what they had do in the foundry is that we were talking before in the pattern shop. This Curly Cullum would go on that cycle about 3 years to build a foundry, build a pattern shop up in the foundry, and then zip it down, and about 3 years to build it up again, and that got the people. Oh, more or less discuss it. That is the local guys. The other guys said, what the hell, let it go, Detroit. We get more money, which was true, you know. But the local yokels didn't want to go down that way. And that's what really held up this the Pattermakers League from I would say, winning in 1939. That it was still under the Detroit Association, Jerry, you know. They would send up the guys and cut a little slack, go up there and raise a little hell, see. And well, they'd come up and then ship the work down to Detroit, see.
I can tell you a few things that I ran into in my organizing as a result of some of these things that had been done prior to that. Arnold Weber asked me one day if I had been over to see such and such a person. I guess he knew that I had.
Yeah.
He says, how did you make out with him? I said, oh, we got along all right. He was a third shift worker, and I went to see him right after he came home from work in the morning.
Uh-huh.
And Arnold kind of grinned, and he says, the reason I asked you, he says, Jimmy went over to see him about the same time of the morning that you did, walked in his kitchen and laid a gun down on the table and ordered his breakfast.
Yeah, he was always target shooting.
I said, what kind of organizing is that? I said, that's just some of the things. And another house I was in, I don't remember who told me about this, but I got a picture of this living room real quick when they were telling me about it, that the door was here, there's a piano over here, and Jimmy Soch, the man of the house was sitting on the piano stool, and Jimmy Soucek and somebody else in the house, and Jimmy says they hadn't said very much according to what I maybe Arnold Weber was with him. I don't know. I don't recall, but
yeah,
Jimmy Soucek says, I guess we're not getting anywhere here, and walked over and wham.
No, he put on his glove first. He had a glove, you know, and he'd walk in, and it was just a skin tight glove. Yeah, and he'd take a crack at the guy.
Who was this? Was
Jimmy Soucek. Jerry says, he represents the jobbers.
He's the business manager for the Jobbers Association in Saginaw, too.
Yeah, but he was our representative at that time, you know, working in the union. A lot of those fellows did that. They went from the union to the other side. See, the same as Curly Cullum that ran the pattern shop.
Well, this was not my type of organizing. I had to beat this down in a lot of places.
Yeah.
And, as soon as it was found out that this wasn't the type of organizing I was doing, I was organizing on the basis of what we were endeavoring to do. I didn't have too much trouble in most places.
Then in the foundry part, they were very afraid of that. There's no seniority deal, you know. They don't recognize it in the jobbing shop, and they were afraid that would be done out. But then we showed them that in the Buick area, you know, that was a GM plant. That we got them a copy of the thing and showed it to them. And that left.
They're afraid they'd lose their seniority.
That's right, yeah. Tenure, that's right. And they were working for less money.
But what we showed them was actually the Buick and the Chevrolet shops. The election was held just a few, two or three months apart.
Yeah,
but we had it at Fisher Body, and we had the contract at Fisher Body, Pontiac Motor, and a couple other places that we had to use as evidence.
What took place then? You had a tripartite agreement. You would have you coming in to represent the Pattermakers League. You'd have the company, and then you'd have the union that was in existence.
The way we bargained in the early days, of course, the first agreements were bargained with each individual shop in General Motors, and then a short time later, we sit down across the table, the same as the UAW did, and negotiated a national agreement. We sat down, and we had representatives in here from all over the country where we had shops like Chicago, Marion, Indiana, Cleveland, Buffalo, I'm just thinking a few of them, where we represented plants in General Motors. Lima, Ohio was one, too.
Yeah.
And we sat down, and as Louis Seaton and George Wright used to say, look around the room, he says, this is a bigger representation than the UAW has in here.
Yeah.
But because they would send their shop representative and the business manager from the union each one of these places, and it did make a big room full of people. And only room for so many around the table. And this is the way we negotiate. And then, of course, very similar to the UAW, then you had your local agreements. I mean, some local conditions that were negotiated separate from the national agreement. I guess the UAW did that the same way, too.
Oh, yeah, I had shift preference.
Those little local issues was negotiated separately, yeah.
Okay. In 1959, the Labor Management Relations Act, commonly known as the Landrum-Griffith Act, exposed a number of corrupt union practices. Did the Pattern Makers League suffer from this exposure?
No, the Pattern Makers League did not suffer anything from the Landrum-Griffith Act because in reading the Landrum-Griffith Act, there was so many things in it that was almost word for word in laws of the Pattern Makers League.
You were mentioning something about having a negotiation with one of the authors of this.
In as much as I'm very well acquainted with Griffin's brother, I asked him one day, I said, what did you do, give him the Pattern Makers League laws to write this, to copy out of it for the Landrum Griffin? He said, no, but he asked me a lot of questions.
I see. So it was a very supportive type of piece of legislation.
There were things in it that a lot of labor unions opposed, like a notice, strike notice, for example, as I recall, was one of the things Landon Griffin put in, as, I think, a 60-day, these different notices. We had those things in the Pattern Makers League.
Yeah, they're automatically in the contracts.
And put them in contracts before they were enacted into the Landon Griffin Act. So anything that he put in that was in the Landon Griffin Act did not adversely affect the Pattern Makers League at all because they were our laws.
Well, we didn't have any trouble with these, what you call them in those days, communist radicals and stuff like that. The guys are too honest to punch. Maybe we had trouble with drinkers, but that would be the main thing, I'd say.
Pattern Makers drink?
What'd you say about the out-of-work list being in the bar?
That was the first out-of-work list the Pattern Makers in Detroit ever had, was in a bar.
Where did this take place? In Detroit itself?
In Detroit. This was back in 1901, I believe. There's a notation right there of it.
A better place for a free lunch.
But they didn't have an office. They didn't have a full-time man, but they had shops that were organized. They had all union men in some of these shops. So they would insist on having a closed shop, but the company said, well, where will... I assumed they said, well, where will I call if I want a man? So they finally had to set up an out-of-work list, and they got this one owner of a bar to agree to have the Pattern Makers out of work list.
Always be somebody there.
In the bar room. So all they had to do was call this bar if they wanted the Pattern Maker.
Presently in Chicago, the 26th convention of the Pattern Makers League is being held. This convention, which brings together every fifth year representatives from 33 states in Washington, D.C., and four Canadian provinces. What is the purpose of this convention?
Well, the purpose of the convention has a number of things. Any association, first of all, so many days, I don't have the exact figures before me, but any laws that they want changed in our league laws, they make these proposals in writing and send them to convention. I believe it's at least 10 or days or 2 weeks before the convention takes place. Then these laws, or these proposed changes, this is one of the things, these proposed changes are first taken up with the Constitution Committee. They mull them over, and a lot of times, this proposed change is almost like this one. Maybe there's four or five proposals of the league that will be combined together. The Constitution Committee then will if it has merits, maybe they'll recommend to the convention that it be enacted. Or they may recommend something else, or may recommend their own solution to the problems that different associations, or maybe even one association has. Or they may recommend to the convention that it be just knocked down. So these things are then taken before the delegates to the convention and voted on. Understand that anything that's voted on in the convention must then come back to each individual association to be voted on too. At each convention also is the election of the general president and the election of five general executive board members. There's five general executive board members, and at each convention they are either re-elected or new ones elected to that office. That's
one question I might have, Andre. I noticed one of these people are from Grand Rapids. How was this decided?
You mean Vern Will?
Yes.
I nominated him.
See. Does he have his office in Grand Rapids?
Did he what?
Does he have his office in Grand Rapids or in D.C.?
No, his office is in his home.
I see.
And
they don't get too much, do they,
see,
Jerry?
Generally, it's been a policy of the pattern to make the general executive board is not paid a salary.
Yeah.
The general executive board is only allowed expenses for mailing, et cetera, or if they have to go to a meeting. The general president may call a meeting of the general executive. Of course, they're paid their expenses. The general executive board, it's been a policy for I don't know how long that no man working as a full-time business manager may hold a job as general executive. He must be a man working on the bench.
Yeah.
And this has been a policy that we've followed for a good many years.
This is similar to a board of directors for a corporation, and they're only paid for the travel time plus
that's
the time
right.
that they're attending a meeting.
They're not paid for anything other than actual expenses incurred.
I see. Do they determine the constitutionality of things which take place within
and
the league?
That's another thing. If somebody appeals a decision somewhere to the league, the general executive board makes these determinations between conventions, along with the general.
Is our president, is he chosen from within the general executive committee?
No.
How is he chosen?
The general president is elected at the league convention. Or if the general president, which happened in the previous general president, resigned between conventions, retired, I should say, between conventions. For what reason, I don't know. He retired in 1960, and the next convention was in 1962. So the general president then was not elected at a convention. It was elected by a referendum vote of the pattern makers of the league.
Mm-hmm.
There were... I think only about two. I don't know how many received votes, but you could vote for anybody you wanted to.
Yeah.
Actually, but it was proposed at the various associations of people who were running. I wouldn't run. I insulted the former general president, I think. He says, why don't you run? I said, number one, because I don't want it.
Yeah. Are you and Mr. Holston rather close in your relationship?
Yes. Yes.
I see. That ties into a particular question I wanted to ask. I noticed Steve earlier had asked how a fellow by the name of George Zirkian lost his position to a rather young fellow, Dave Markham from the Saginaw Association, who I think Dave is 30 years of age. He was our business agent for a couple of years, and prior to that had been our president for about 4 years. In spite of the fact that his experience isn't too diversified, Dave beat the Zirkian for the position of District 10 secretary. I noticed that in September of 1971, George Zirkian wrote Gunnar Holstrom a very... I don't know really how to label the letter. Nonetheless, he stated that in this letter, Gunnar Holstrom had declined to take care of his duties. Are you familiar with the piece of with the letter I'm speaking of?
I'm familiar with quite a lot of letters he wrote.
I see. Obviously, there was a friction of some
Whether
sort.
Whether I'm familiar with that or not, I'm not sure, but I think I've probably seen it.
What caused this friction between Mr. Zirkian and Mr. Holstrom?
This would be a hard thing for me to say other than... In my own opinion, I think a lot of people will go along with this, that Zirkian, I even go farther than what I was about to say. George Zirkian was an employee of Ford Motor Car Company. When I carved the unit out at Ford, George Zirkian was opposed to the Pattern Makers League and campaigned against the Pattern Makers League at the Ford Motor Car Company and very bitter because we won it. George Zirkian, a few years later, endeavored, and I have a sworn affidavit from Joseph McCusker, international representative of the UAW, that George Zirkian, with two or three other, I think three other representatives of Ford Motor Car Company, came to him and wanted to know how they could get the pattern makers back into the UAW at Ford. This is, I can show you this, I still hold that in my possession, sworn affidavit by McCusker.
Zirkian's actions then were actually subversive?
His actions to me have been subversive ever since he's been in there. I'll say it to him.
Well, how did he capture that job in Detroit in the first place?
By the Ford Motor Car Company.
Well, he did, Jerry, huh?
Well, after all, we had over 400 members at Ford, and if he was successful in getting those out, he could command
a
big vote.
He moved them as a block, yeah.
Then how did he lose it 4 years later? I noticed that Detroit voted for Dave Markham.
Well, he apparently didn't get a vote out from Ford, and I was down to that meeting a few months ago when they voted against him over 2-1 to direct him to vote for Markham.
Is that right?
So that was a pretty tough thing for him to swallow. He says, thank you all, and got up and stormed out of the meeting.
How do you like that?
In the meantime, what's taken place with Mr. Zirkian? Has he gone back to the shop?
I don't know what he's done. I really don't know.
He's had a heart attack, hasn't he, Jerry, in the last year or so?
He's had a couple heart attacks.
He has, huh?
At least one. Uh-huh. Well, Markham took his place for a while after the heart attack.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
Now, it's been... The only thing, I haven't been around, I haven't been active, but my only summarization of why he lost it, I think you made that remark or asked that question a while ago.
Well, I think you summarized it pretty well.
I was going to summarize or answer it a little bit more direct, that the majority of the people out in the district have found out.
Yeah.
How can a person be, he's a representative of the Pattern Makers League. He is supposed to be a representative of the general president. How can he honestly represent the league and going out and tearing it down all the time?
Yeah, well, I never heard the guy tear it down myself, Jerry. When he was running against Cobblesh. Remember when he was running against Cobblesh?
Yeah.
For that job? And by damn, if he didn't come down and talk, and the Saginaw Association voted for him instead of Cobblesh.
Yeah.
Yeah, Steve, in September 8th of 1971, he made a few statements like this. The concluding paragraph is, "Do not attempt to hide behind the fact that we're too small. We are, regardless of size, a labor union. We have proven that size does not necessarily reflect strength. You are the general president. Start performing as such." This is a letter that he wrote to the general president.
Oh, yeah.
Now I noticed 1 year later he is pushed out. This force that pushed him out, was it a power play of any sort?
I couldn't see it as, it couldn't very well be a power play.
It was either a power play or a sleeper. His crew went to sleep.
Well,
his crew dissipated.
This was not handled exactly like the district secretary is normally elected. The normal thing to do, if you want to pull a power play like you're talking about, there's only, I think, 11 delegates to the district now, and six opposing him, six for Markin and five for Zirkian, would put Markin in. Mm-hmm. I don't mean by associations voting it. These 11 people can vote him in. But this happened that it wasn't done that way. Most of the associations, really, the membership had a chance to vote on it before it came to the district meeting. I don't know whether it did up in Saginaw or not. It didn't in all.
Well, he was elected at the meeting before Saginaw even voted. Dave was
elected at the meeting before Saginaw voted. Yeah. Well, anyway, in Detroit, for example, in Zirkian's home association, he was directed to vote for...
Yeah, they were instructed delegates.
And the ironical thing, over in Grand Rapids delegate was instructed to vote for Zirkian.
Is that right?
And I know a lot of people in Grand Rapids that certainly was the other way.
You might have, I speculate a bit. Had Mr. Zirkian retained his position as secretary, and had he gone out to the convention, rumor is that he intended to run for the presidency. Do you think chances of success would have been in existence at all?
I don't know whether he'd run for the general president, but I was at a meeting, of a district meeting, last November or December, and George Zirkian at that time stated that he would not run for general president. Of course, I've heard him make statements before that of one thing and do something else. I've always believed in running and being on a job district secretary, and I've... This has to be approved by the general, your election has to be approved by the General Executive Board of the League. And when I was elected in 1945, I recall that it came back to me that one of the General Executive Board members was a member of the Detroit Association, mm-hmm. and he was asked for a recommendation. And all I was told was that that he said, well, the only thing I can say to you is he's honest. I'll tell you something, that goes a long ways.
Yeah,
that's true.
And I can't say that for him.
Yeah. Yeah, right. Well, that's how it goes, Jerry.
All right, in District 10, which is the entire state of Michigan, is comprised of Albion, Detroit, Grand Rapids, Muskegon, Saginaw, and Warren. What is the total membership of this district? Do you recall?
When I left office, the total membership in the district was between 35 and 3,600. And I might say as a... when I took office, the paid-up membership was probably less than 1,400.
So Michigan has actually grown in spite of the fact that the nation has remained somewhat stagnant.
Well,
Warren gave you a bunch.
Warren, when I left office, had 800 members.
Mm-hmm. The Central Foundry, our foundry, gave him another bunch.
Yeah. Well, not all. You see,
300.
Now, the records show in 1946, if you go to the record, Detroit had probably 2,000 members. But I know for a fact they only had about 1,200 good standing members.
Yeah, they paid for capital, right?
And I went up to Flint to start organizing. There were people up there that were still on the books of the Detroit Association who hadn't paid dues in 6 years.
Huh. So how do you explain
the league
this
doesn't
then?
Let them do that anymore. The league insists on them on the suspending them.
Yeah.
Right. How do you reconcile this then, Jerry? A statement is made that a number of years ago, the membership league had a number of 15,000, and it still remains at 15,000. So obviously the Pattermakers League is not growing.
It's not growing, no. And
it's being chiseled on it.
The Pattern Makers League, the number of pattern makers in North America are not growing either, actually. As
no,
I understand
the
it, there,
being,
there's a number of places, we in this area are about the only places in place in the league where the number of pattern makers are not being eliminated. In other words, on the East Coast, and this started a good many years ago, pattern making just become nothing.
Yeah.
Now the pattern makers, some of these pattern makers moved with the industry and some of them went into other businesses.
Yeah.
Of course, I'm only told this from the people on the East Coast. But I can understand and knowing the places that went out of the, I mean, there's just no pattern business there anymore.
Yeah.
But we here in the state of Michigan, as far as Pattern Maker League is concerned, and in the Midwest, have
a automotive heavy industry.
Heavy industry,
yeah.
But on the other hand, there's drastic changes taking place now that's cutting out more pattern makers. For example, General Motors could have changed models, what is it, every changing from 1 year to 3 or 4 years, or going
to
change
to
models?
Five years.
Fisher Body 23, that makes the die patterns,
yeah,
or the bulk of the die pattern for General Motors, right after this was announced, that was a place that maintained year in and year out, around 100 pattern makers or a little better, closed that shop. Well, some of these pattern makers are probably not going back to pattern work either.
Yeah.
Do you feel as whether there's an actual change in trade or profession?
There'll be a related trade. They'll be tool and die. They'll stay in there. And that is the woodmen. I don't know. What are the woodmen going to, Jerry?
I'm talking now about woodmen at the Fisher Body there. Practically all of them are die pattern makers.
Yeah.
They're not the type of pattern maker who can go into a shop and take on
a job.
No.
Uh-huh.
I had a great experience. I never put my name on the out of work list but once in Detroit, and that was back in 1942, one or two, I think.
Uh-huh.
I looked at the list and here was something ahead of me. I said, I'm going to have time to go home and start a project at home. And I had a little job I wanted to do, building the back entrance on the house, and went home and worked a half a day on it, and we sat down on my lunch and got a call from the Detroit office. And said, how do you like to go to work at Wayne Pattern? I said, I always thought I'd like to find out whether it's as notorious as I hear about, but what happened to those other 60 men on the out of work? Oh, they're dive pattern makers. This is a motor job.
Yeah, they're more or less carpenters then.
Okay. Organized labor, then, which is presently in the intervention phase, has become as large as the corporation with which it negotiates, approximately 19 million. How do you feel the Pattern Makers League has managed to retain its independence thus far?
I think mainly by the pattern makers understanding that they are a highly, let's say, the most highly skilled craft in industry, and that they it's necessary to for them to maintain their identity in order to at least obtain partially what they figure they have.
Yeah, I think they're in the same category. They, I think, are even smaller than the die sinkers
are a type of people that really should have been on the metal side of the pattern tree.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. They make it same the same as we do.
And
they
say
might call them.
It's close work.
Yeah, very close. And they, I mean, they're in that same skill group, and I would say less than 15,000, Jerry.
Oh, there aren't anywhere near.
No.
No.
Much smaller because they make it out of that heavy steel, and hell, that lasts forever.
I heard at one time how many there was, and it was a very small amount.
Yeah.
All right. Do you think that the league will be able to maintain this autonomy in the future?
Well, I think that as long as they have patterns to be made, I'm not one to say that I don't believe they will maintain their autonomy. And I'll put it this way, that the Pattern Makers League will maintain their autonomy as long as the pattern makers want a Pattern Makers League.
Yeah, and particularly in the small shops, if they ever do have that election in the larger shops, and the UAW wins, then they'll be overwhelmed. That is there, but they'll still maintain their dignity and their identity in the small shop.
Even if they have to go back to the days when they could, and most understand this, of all these associations in the Pattern Makers League, there's only a very, very few that have a full-time business manager. Mm-hmm. Even as large as Saginaw is, and they're about, let's say, sixth or seventh in the league. They don't have a full-time business manager. I think there's only about six full-time business managers.
Yeah.
I haven't counted them lately.
Yeah, well, that's what we were aiming at when we were wanting that Flint deal.
Of course.
One last question, if I might, Ms. Norrie. You obviously have negotiated contracts in Detroit. You have set in on the negotiations that have taken place between the Pattern Makers League and the large corporate structure, primarily GM. What does this feel like? What is your personal observation? Is there a great deal of pressure?
As far as I am personally concerned, I never felt any great pressure. The main people, at the top of the negotiating team, first of all, negotiated with Louis Seaton. He was across the table from me. And then George Wright came along, and George Wright and I retired about the same time. So, well, Don Pfeiffer was, but I didn't happen to have to sit across the table with Don, but I did get acquainted with him before I retired. But actually, as far as pressure is concerned, no, I never felt pressure. And I always felt I had very good relations with the negotiating, or the top negotiator anyway, in General Motors. I usually knew about where we were all the time. If I didn't, he'd take me off on the side and tell me where we were. I'd want to know where we're going. And I never backed off of telling him where I thought we could go.
I'd like to take this opportunity to thank both of you gentlemen. Obviously, retirement agrees with both of you. Mr. Noe and his 80-acre farm he enjoys thoroughly. And Mr. Stevens living in Bridgeport with his very gracious wife.
I have beer from right up to our back door.
Is that right? I'd like to take this opportunity to thank Mr. Stevens for driving down to Holly with me, giving the pleasant company on the way. This evening has been very informational, and I hope it serves a very specific purpose in the annals of the Oral History Department in Saginaw Valley College. Good evening.